Cairn Cross. I'm the head of an Oxford college, but more to the point, I was chairing the Economic and Social Research Council when we launched this splendid programme on an unsuspecting world. And so I think it was felt fitting that having been there at the beginning, I should also be there at, well, not the end, but at least at the first stopping point along the way, which is a great pleasure. I've been here all day. I've been in not all but most of the sessions. I think it's been an extraordinarily interesting day. It's a very good programme. It's covered an enormous amount of ground. And what I'm going to do in a moment is to ask the five people who have chaired the five panels we've had so far, four plus Carol Proper, who was on the panel, says, as Nick McPherson has sadly had to go off to try to do something about the deficit. And Carol is going to join this group, and just all of them whom are going to say a little bit about what really hit them out of the panel that they were chairing. And then after that, we're going to hear from Martin Wheel, and we hope from Gus O'Donnell, who is still at his desk trying to run a country, and who will join us, we hope, at round about 4 o'clock. This session has two rather different questions. One is, how can we make ends meet in the public services? And that, in a sense, is the question that has hung over, or should have hung over, the whole of the day. Peter Riddell asked this morning whether the public really grasped the scale of the crisis, and the answer is, of course, absolutely not. It doesn't. Very few people do yet, even after this week. But I think what is clear, probably to everyone in this room, is that there is going to be a level of pressure on public services in the coming decade that none of us have seen in our lifetimes. And the question that came up in the final session that I was at in this room 20 minutes ago from Sir Andrew Lickerman, who was in the Treasury and is now head of the London Business School, was, what practical help can we offer? And that, in a sense, brings us, and what can we say about what should happen to get us through this really terrifying decade that stretches ahead of us? And that, I think, brings one to the second question for this session, which is, how can we make research meet practice in the 2010s? Now, usually it's a question of how can we make practice take account of research. So maybe the way the question is phrased suggests that we're going into a period that is unprecedented, and we need to have some answers to give to people. And I think we haven't quite got down that track as far as we should at this stage. I'm going now to hand over to the five chairs. Maybe out of their sessions will come some responses to these issues. I'm going to start with George Gaskell, who chaired the session on public attitudes with which we began the day. George.
Thank you very much. Well, my role on the commissioning panel was as the methodologist. I'm not a political scientist. I was there to ensure methodological rigour and so forth. And certainly, judging by the poster session downstairs, the programme has achieved research of both high technical quality and of societal significance. And since I'm not a political scientist, this morning for me was a very interesting introduction to some of these burning issues that face us. But what struck me listening to these, the presentations and the questions and answers, was just how much of my original discipline — I think of myself now as an undisciplined social scientist, but at some point I was trained in social psychology — and it seemed to me that many of the questions do relate to basic social psychological processes. So the impact of choice on perceived satisfaction, which John talked about this morning, and he finds it's not proven. There were discussions about the representations of the crisis. It may well be the case, like climate change, that some crises are just too big for individuals to grasp, that one is, quite a bit of research on climate change shows, people almost get into a position of rationalized apathy. There's nothing you can do about it but blame someone else, whether it's government, whether it's business, and so forth. Then there were interesting questions about how and why it is that politicians and our political system seems to cultivate certain expectations. I guess those are expectations that tax will never go up, that public services will always improve, and life will always be rosy. I suppose that's more of a sort of socio-political question than a social psychological question. And then I thought an interesting comment from the back was on intergenerational equity. Will the young generation be prepared to subsidize the old generation, even if the old generation, as we heard, is giving up its freedom passes? So I think it's fascinating to reflect on the ending of this program, because when the program was initiated and we had various meetings with Chris in All Souls, and I realized why it's called All Souls, because Chris seemed to be the only person there, and this enormous building, lovely library, never saw anybody, but presumably there were the spirits of the age were gathered there. So, the whole of this program has not been predicated on a very deep crisis or a very deep problem with respect to public sector finance. It'll be interesting to see from the experts how the understandings that come out of this program can be, in a sense, automatically translated into completely differing social times, social and economic times. And I wonder whether we may look back, if research funding is cut, as one expects it will, at something of a golden opportunity lost to do systematic research on how people actually respond to a crisis of the depth that Peter Riddle seemed to suggest we're all walking into, with the at least some of the politicians walking in somewhat blinded. So I found it a fascinating morning. I don't want to comment on the political science insights. Others can do that better than I. But I thought it was a great start to the conference, and judging by the continued discussions, conversations, and so forth, the way in which Chris has and the group supporting him set up and organized this conference, it seems to have worked very well. Thank you.
Good. Great. Clive Grace did the session on regulation.
Thank you. Well, we looked at the question of whether we could regulate our way to better public services, and if anything, this is an even more important question now than it was when it was formulated as a significant part of the programme, because it's often observed that governments, broadly speaking, have two major instruments, money and regulation, and of course we know what the position is with money. In terms of what came out of the contributions, we had three, Colin Talbot, Mary Dixon Woods, and Frank Vibert, and there was both difference and commonality in the issues they raised for us. But the thing that was perhaps most striking was the way in which they each emphasised different dimensions of the sheer complexity of the systems for regulating public services. The complexity of the regulatory frameworks and the professional and expert knowledge and practices embedded in them, the complexity of the human and behavioural context and its consequences for how best to achieve desired outcomes, and the complexity of the institutional nexus and the value systems in which regulatory practice is necessarily located. So all of this complexity puts a huge premium on understanding not only these contexts, but also how best to intervene in them. It questions also whether the dynamics of politics and of administration are conducive to the kinds of solutions which could be adequately tailored to cope with such complexity, because neither politics nor administration necessarily invite subtlety and complexity in the kind of solutions which they regularly allow. Thirdly, there was particular concern to get beyond operational and performance regulation and beyond regulatory methods, and to consider the wider questions of regulatory governance and the principles which should inform regulatory effort. So very much wanting to get away from regulatory impact assessments and some of the other procedural aspects, and look at some of the more subtle ways in which outcomes could be achieved. When each of them were put to the sword in terms of asking the question whether we can regulate for better public services, the panel were clearly very sceptical. But ultimately, they all acknowledged that we could not and would not be able to do without regulation entirely. Each would tolerate it only, though, on condition. Either on condition that regulation should eschew Pavlovian reliance on rules and procedures and instead seek to mobilise behaviour through engagement and participation designed to achieve desired outcomes, or on condition that the high priest experts of regulation are themselves held to account against the realities of what communities need and want, or on condition that the regulation of public services is indeed informed and guided by an understanding and appreciation of the institutional and behavioural complexity in which it seeks to intervene. All of this raises some profound questions for the accountability and the independence of regulators and of the guiding principles which motivate and shape their interventions.
Good. Thank you very much. Carol, your session dealt with various issues around incentives.
That's right. So the kind of homework question was, can we use incentives to get better public services? And I think, I mean, it's difficult being one of the speakers, but I think I'd say that the broad answer from the three speakers was yes, incentives will play a role and will be useful, and the programme has shown that they have. What was quite interesting, I think, was that the range of incentives that was discussed, and in fact George Boyne discussed a set of incentives that I think many people might not think of when they first think of the term incentives, was talking about the legal and administrative incentives and ramping up legal and administrative incentives to do well. And he gave a couple of examples where the research in the programme has shown that both legal incentives in terms of being able to be taken to judicial review and both administrative incentives have improved outcomes in local service use. Julian and I both talked, I think, about more traditional financial incentives, and we discussed, I think, within that clutch of them, the issues around a kind of, on one hand, a target and terror regime, which was quite close to performance management, and a competition regime, which is closer to allowing choice and competition. And I think there's evidence from the programme that both of them work, in the sense that they achieve the desired outcomes, and certainly in terms of some of the target regimes, do not have too many undesired outcomes that have large costs associated with them. I think in reflection, I think that probably the balance, though, of the kind of arguments that were coming on from the panel were an issue that there was a preference, and I think Julian expressed this quite strongly, a preference for competition, because it was a more positive incentive system than one with the negative consequences of targets and naming and shaming and other issues that come around targets where you have less kind of choice about what you do and failing them is associated with penalties. I think that those whole issues raised kind of a number of issues from the floor, which I think I'd like to say there were kind of three maybe. The first issue, as always in these areas, is the unintended consequences. And do we think that the unintended consequences of incentivising one set of actions is large? And I think generally we don't actually know enough about the cost effectiveness of different models. We probably know enough about the cost effectiveness of different specific programmes, but not about the whole kind of regime of whether competition and choice is more cost-effective than, say, targets or than legal or administrative. And that's a very big issue, I think. It's not just looking at one small programme, but looking at the whole architecture. Secondly, I think one of the points from the floor made by Nick Bosanquet quite strongly was that when you have things like target regimes, they play to political popularity. Politicians put in targets for things they care about, i.e. things that are going to win them votes. And this may mean that target regimes mean that resources are diverted away from other needy groups who don't hit so many political buttons. I think that's probably fair point and true. And the third issue that kind of we ended up discussing was the whole issue, if you have incentives to do something, what do you do with the providers in the public service, or indeed outside the public service, who are failing? And we talked about the analogy, perhaps, with banks, where they're too big to fail. And certainly some hospitals within their local health economies appear to be in the problem of too big to fail. We know they fail. They, in terms of incentives, they're not performing well. They're not performing well in terms of competition. But we're unable to get rid of them. So I think that in terms of lessons going forward, there needs to be a stronger regime around failure and a stronger, maybe taking lessons from some of the issues that have happened around the banks about how you deal with getting rid of failing institutions faster.
Thank you very much. Now, Steve Martin stood in for Sandra Nutley in the session which dealt with the regions and the devolutionary issues. So, Steve, over to you.
I think our session looked principally at the impact of devolution on public services and notions of civil society. Thank you. And then spent most of its time reflecting upon what the likely consequences of those divergences in public services might be for the future of devolution. So would the UK state become weaker or stronger, fragment, or be more likely to hold together over the next 10 years? And I think it's fair to say that the general view was that there has been policy divergence between the different parts of the UK since 1999, but that this was less because Wales or Scotland or Northern Ireland had been pioneering new innovative approaches than because they'd stuck with the old tried and tested approaches whilst England had been developing new strategies for public service reform around markets, competition, choice, targets and terror, those familiar kind of English recipes for public service improvement and reform. So the notion was that England has adapted and evolved and innovated whilst other parts of the UK haven't to the same degree. And that means that citizens in different parts of the UK now are likely to receive different kinds of service. But as Ian McLean pointed out, the extremities of that are dampened down by the grant funding regimes which exist. So one of the impacts of the Barnett formula, for example, is that Scots pay less for their services than they might otherwise do. So there was a notion of some policy divergence, but that constrained by the funding formulae, which we have described by Ian as incentive hostile grant regimes. That, I think, then posed for us quite significant questions about what the nature of Britishness was. Vic Vernon raised the question of what was the point of Britain in that context, and the extent to which the English might be prepared to continue to tolerate this situation where there's no longer equality either of contribution to the costs of public services nor benefits in terms of the outcomes of those public services. Charlie Jeffrey suggested that there was a real danger that this was weakening social democracy. I think Vernon had the same sort of view, that the central state in the UK lacks many of the instruments of control over the devolved administrations which other more formally federal states might have in place. So we had a whole debate about the extent to which this situation was sustainable. Some of the contributions from the floor, I think, suggested that as we face more austere times, there may be less enthusiasm amongst the devolved countries for further devolution, that there might be a sense in which sticking together makes more intrinsic sense than it, instinctive sense than it has over the last 10 years. So we, I was going to say, descended into a debate, but we stumbled into a debate around the appetite for further devolution and the extent to which that might have implications for the way in which English people and England view the nature of Britain. Running alongside that, we had a very interesting discussion about the nature of localism. Somebody asked why was it that all the political parties seemed to be in favour of localism? Was that just a product of the stage we are in the electoral cycle? Ian said all the political parties are in favour of localism, but the people, the citizenry, consistently abhor postcode lotteries, and how are we going to square that circle? And we ended up with a debate about which services might be considered to be truly local and therefore fair game for localism, and which services, which at the moment are delivered through local authorities or other local service providers, are in fact not local services at all, where it's fair for people to expect to get roughly the same kind of service for the same cost right across the country.
I think I sat in on a part of that session, and I think the stunner question was Ian McLean asking, could we retain the concept of social citizenship as meaning anything if the level of welfare benefits was lower in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland than it is in England? That produced a certain frisson. Right, now, our last session. Peter Smith, you were dealing mainly with metrics, I think, metrics and management.
Thank you. Pull
the mic over well so you can be heard.
Okay. Thanks very much, Francis. We had three excellent presentations from Tim Holt, Tim Lernig and Deborah Wilson, and I'm just going to try and synthesise what was said there. The title of the session, or the first part of the title, was Managing Public Services by Numbers, and I have to say my immediate reaction was, how would managing public services without numbers look like, and how would we manage? So there is something of a tautology in this question, and I'll come back to this at the end of my comments, but I think nevertheless it clearly the UK has really been or at least England has been a trailblazer for the world in the prominence given to measurement in the running of public services. The broad areas that our speakers covered included things such as what range of indicators should be collected. How should we aggregate them? The point was made that the precise definition of the indicator is important. It's easy for politicians to say we want to reduce health inequalities, but actually how do we measure health inequalities? There was several speakers raised the issue of overinterpretation of the performance measures, that actually the variations we see are very often not very meaningful. They can occur by chance. There was the old chestnut, but very important one, of unintended consequences of focusing too strongly on single indicators. And actually this gave rise to the consequence that we really need to keep good surveillance across the whole of the public services with metrics so that we can actually spot those unintended consequences and not rely on anecdote about tents being set up outside accident emergency departments or whatever else was being reported as happening. And finally, there was the theme that data collection must be cost-effective. It must be useful for management, and it must be useful for users of the services and the broader public. So what did I take from this? For the second part of this, which is, can we do better in the 2010s? Well, I think the key message that came through to me from this was that a lot of the problems came from focusing excessively on single indicators and specific metrics. And it seems to me increasingly, given our data capabilities, that actually the important direction we should be going in now is one of disclosure of information. Widespread collection of information is becoming very cheap. It should be a routine part of management. I think the most important thing is to make sure that infrastructure is put in place. There's a key role at a national level for ensuring, for benchmarking purposes, that definitions are standard across institutions and across countries. In my belief, that would be the way things would go. And that would be useful not only for managers, but also for service users. And this is a theme that came through from the discussion, also for the professionals. Because I think if there's one weakness we see throughout our public services, it's the absence It's the failure of professionals to take advantage of data to improve their own performance, to benchmark themselves, and to harness the power of these data. Finally, you asked for a message for policy. Andrew Lickerman challenged us that what are we learning new from this programme? Well, one of the problems is that we are, as researchers, we have laboured under quite difficult circumstances trying to evaluate some interesting policy reforms. And it seems to me there's one message as researchers we should give to policy. It is, please try and set up your innovations in an experimental form that can actually be evaluated properly and that we can actually give you the answers much more readily than the labours we sometimes have to go through. So thank you very much.
Good.
Now, before we move on to the next bit, I wondered if any of you who had sat in on these sessions wanted to give just one point that had really hit you during the day. Please, no speeches, but let's have a few points. Where's the roving mics got to? Could we have this gentleman first? And then somebody else stick up a hand and the next mic can go to them. Who else is going to put a hand up? Yeah.
My name is Richard Bacon. I'm a member of the Commons Public Accounts Committee, so I'm one of these dreadful politicians who tries to win votes. And much of the comment about winning votes has suggested that there's something unclean about it, and it's something you really shouldn't try to do. The opening session with John Curtis asked the question, can we afford choice in an age of austerity, which I thought was one of the most interesting, if tendentious, questions I've ever heard. I think Sir Humphrey Appleby, if he'd been designing an opinion poll, would have been very pleased with that question. Dictators throughout the ages have asked similar questions. Can we afford elections in a time of crisis? And, of course, choice of the people, my customers, is what it's all about. Alan Johnson was, of course, quite right to ignore the professional advice on drugs, because although it said 3 million people use cannabis every weekend, that's 10% of the voting population, 90% don't.
And he's listening to his customers.
Right now, sorry, Francis, I'll come on to it straight away. My question is this. I've been listening
to this
programme.
Not a question, a point. That was what I asked you for.
My question.
Point you took away,
my question. I'll ask. Oh, wasn't it a question?
No, I said, what point did you take away?
The point I'd like to make is this. If we are to get more, if we're going to make this work in the forthcoming crisis that we all know is facing us, then some of the answer is going to be about getting more for less. Economists call this productivity. But I've heard nothing today at all about getting more for less. And
okay.
As a politician, I'd like to.
Good. Thanks. Anybody else want to raise a point that they've heard today that they'd like us all to take away? No? Not a single one? Okay. In that case, we will move swiftly on because we have two very interesting speakers to finish off this terrific conference. The first of them is Martin Wheel, who's been director of the National Institute for Social and Economic Research since 1995, who has been a sort of Greek chorus to the events we've seen unfolding over the past decade, and has illuminated it with a lot of extraordinary perceptive economic commentary, and it's great to have him here as one of the final speakers of the day. Martin.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me this afternoon. Now I have a title slide and then three slides that I'd like to show. The title of the conference is hopefully described as Prosperity, Austerity and Recovery. I think it might have been more realistically called Prosperity and Austerity, because looking into the future, I don't really see very much prospect for a recovery, at least if by recovery you mean returning to the sort of situation that we experienced until a couple of years ago. In my talk, I would like to focus on macroeconomic issues, but also obviously to draw attention to the interrelation between those issues and the issues of what I could call public sector management that we've been hearing about today. If I could have the first slide, please. This gives us an indication of how we've got into the position that we've got into. This shows four lines as index numbers with 1997 equals 100. The top red line is the growth in nominal public consumption. That's public spending on goods and services. The next line, the blue line, is growth in nominal GDP. So you can see what I think we all know, that public consumption has grown faster than GDP. The share of public consumption in GDP has risen. But when we actually look at what's been delivered in real terms, and by real terms I'm talking as national accountants talk, not as the Treasury talks. So for me, real terms means measuring the volume of public goods and services that have been delivered rather than measuring their costs in terms of the costs in the economy as a whole. When we look at what's happened in volume terms as a national accountant would define them, we can see that public consumption has grown roughly in line with the volume of GDP. So the problem that we've had, or the reality that we've had, is that the share of spending on GDP, the share of spending on public consumption, has increased substantially over the last 10 years in order to deliver a volume of services as best we can measure them, which has grown only in line with GDP. And this, of course, isn't a new problem. It's well known. It's been well known for years that the cost of public sector services tends to rise faster than costs in the economy as a whole. If I could move on to the next slide, please. You can see that that's not because wage costs in the public sector move very differently from those in the economy as a whole. This chart shows average earnings in the public sector and in the private sector, and they have kept broadly in step. What happens is that, at least as we measure it, productivity in public sector services grows much less rapidly than productivity does in the economy as a whole. And indeed, the latest ONS figures show, I think, that productivity in the public sector declined by 0.3% a year over the period 1997 to 2007. Now, I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. You can also find private sector services in which measured productivity has declined, but it is a reality that has to be faced when we consider, first of all, the public sector as it is, and secondly, where the public sector might get to as we move ahead. What is the situation likely to be in the future? Could I have the next slide, please? Well, the crisis that we have seen has, as best we can judge, led to a permanent or semi-permanent loss of output. This graph shows again three lines. The purple line shows GDP as it actually is, with National Institute forecasts stretching forward from 2008 to 2017. They may be right or they may be wrong, but they're the way we see it. The blue line shows what would have happened if the economy had simply grown at 2.5% a year steadily from 1997. And the green line, to be seen against the right-hand scale, is a measure of the gap between the two. So you can see that from being slightly above the trend line before the crisis, we've now fallen a long way below, and by 2017, we expect the economy to be 5% smaller, roughly speaking, than we had thought it was going to be before the crisis. And I think although the Treasury has slightly faster trend growth rates, it's fair to say that their view of the permanent loss of output is not terribly different from this. Certainly not as different from this as to lead to a fundamentally different analysis. Well, a number of things follow from this. If your income is lower, you would expect to cut your coat to fit your cloth. So if your income is lower, you would expect your expenditure on almost everything you do to be lower. I mean, roughly speaking, and it is only roughly speaking, it's quite helpful to make the assumption that people think of their expenditure in reasonably constant proportions. So you spend just over 20% of national income on public consumption, you spend so much on food, so much on other things, and for want of more detailed information, assume those shares are roughly constant. The consequence is that if GDP is reduced by 5% relative to what we would have expected, we should expect to see public sector consumption, provision of goods and services, to fall roughly in line. Actually, in volume terms, it might not be quite as sharp as that, because wage costs are likely to be relatively lower than they would have been. And I made the point earlier that public sector costs in normal circumstances rise faster than average. Well, that's because of their labour content. Consequently, if you have a downward jump in wages, you might expect a relative cheapening of public sector, a relative reduction of public sector costs. So perhaps we should expect on this basis to see the volume of public sector consumption decline by, say, 3 or 4%. And one aspect of the pre-budget report, which, as far as I know, hasn't actually received much comment because it was in the economy section and not the public finances section, there the Treasury forecast shows the volume of public sector consumption falling by 2% in 2011 and I think 1.5% in 2012. So that, broadly speaking, is the Treasury projecting the downward adjustment in public consumption that you would expect to see going with the sort of reduction in income that we think is likely. Of course, unfortunately, that's not the whole of the problem that the public sector faces, because there are three other things that have been happening to it. First of all, the tax take, the share of GDP delivered by the tax structure as a proportion of GDP, has fallen, at least temporarily, as a result of the crisis. Views can differ on how far and how fast that will recover. Certainly the Treasury are more optimistic than I am on that issue, and I very much hope they'll be right and I'll be wrong, of course, because if the tax take doesn't really recover without increases in taxation, then the deficit is likely to stay high for longer and the need to reduce public spending will be all the greater. So that's issue number one. Issue number two, well, we all know the national debt is rising sharply, and that means that debt interest has to be rising, and that, no, with a given bundle of tax revenue, has to be paid for by cutting either public consumption or state benefits. The third issue is that in the short term, the number of people not working has increased. That raises rather than reduces benefit costs. In the longer term, that may not be too important, but we know that the population is aging and that's driving up benefit costs. So taking all these things together, we have a rather sharp squeeze on the bundle of public money which can be spent on goods and services. What are some of the implications of that? Well, we have heard quite a lot about the importance of protecting frontline services. The National Health Service is top of every politician's list. It seems to me that this is likely to lead to a grave misallocation of resources. I suggested earlier that, roughly speaking, people choose to spend their money in reasonably constant proportions. Well, arguably, the income elasticity of expenditure on health is more than one. For each 1% increase in income, people possibly want their health expenditure, their health consumption, to rise by 1.1%. The statistical evidence, as you might expect, isn't clear on this issue, but no one has suggested that the elasticity is below one. The implication of that, of course, is that if you have a, say, 4 or 5% cut in income, you should cut expenditure on health more than in proportion, because when people have less money, they want to spend a smaller proportion on health and a larger proportion of other things. So at the macro level, we, I think, have a real worry that the reaction to the crisis will be to create rather a severe misallocation of public sector consumption relative to the evidence that we have on public preferences based on expenditure patterns more generally. Well, if I move on from the aggregate to the specific, how can we make ends meet? Well, I think the answer is that making ends meet simply means recognising that there will be less public consumption. Can that be achieved without a reduction in services as people see them? Well, I would expect not, but since people will be poorer, I would expect also that they'll be prepared to tolerate worse public services. What about incentives? Can they be used to improve performance? Well, we heard about the distinction between target and terror and a competitive approach. When money is very tight, my guess is that target and terror will be much easier to implement than incentives and carrots dangling in front of people. I'm not saying that I would necessarily recommend target and terror, but it seems to me that that's where we might well end up. What about the point we heard earlier, or the point that was mentioned in the section on management by numbers, that is it a worry that people's satisfaction is likely to decline? Tim Holt suggested that satisfaction is a lagging indicator. Well, my own view is that if people always want things without paying for them, they always want things they can't afford. I wouldn't be terribly surprised if satisfaction does decline, but that would be something that I would expect to happen as a result of the crisis. And one can reasonably make the point, it's been an issue floating around a bit, that arguably too much attention has been paid by governments to the satisfaction that people derive from public sector services, and perhaps not enough in terms of how far they meet their fundamental purpose. I must say, I would certainly survive in a hospital where the nurses were rude to me than die in one where the nurses were polite to me. I think the reality we face is that expectations will have a substantial adjustment to make. From the perspective of the economy as a whole, I don't think the adjustment is as large as it was in 1974. Of course, that adjustment and the difficulty that we had in coping with it led to 5 or 6 years of really rather rapid inflation. I'm hopeful that the adjustment can be made more easily than that. But perhaps as we look ahead to what is likely to be a rather grim decade of austerity, certainly for the public sector, we should perhaps be grateful if we get to the end of the 2010s without the sort of events that beset the world in the decade that started in 1910. Thank you very much.
A rather dark note to end on, Martin. Our final speaker of the conference, Sir Gus O'Donnell, was Permanent Secretary of the Treasury between 2002 and 2005 and Cabinet Secretary since 2005. And I think we can all say that there probably is no civil servant whose memoirs we will all long to read more eagerly than those of Sir Gus.
Thank you. you'll have to wait a very long time because I'm definitely not going to write my memoirs. I think after Martin's gloom, let me kind of try and raise you up a bit because I spent part of today reading through all of the posters, and I'd just like to say a big thank you to Christopher and the ESRC. I think there's enormous amount of scope and food for thought. I particularly welcome the fact that there's a directory there. I asked Christopher about this, so that people working inside government on the policies can actually get at the best possible evidence and understand what's going on. So I think that's great. On your section on data and methods, I mean, you can't help but realise as you go through this, and I, for this, blame the University of Warwick, which started me my being interested in econometrics. You can't help wishing that we had some common data standards and better data. It's unbelievably frustrating, as you rightly say, that there are various different studies, and trying to think about how does that study compare with that study when the data aren't comparable, the international data aren't comparable, and even when you think they are, there's a lovely little poster telling us about bias in answer to questions and have to realign them. That's bad enough, and then you get the difference in methods. And, it's very, very different the way people analyse these sorts of problems, and trying to compare and contrast something which is obviously, and there weren't many equations in the stuff I looked at, comparing, you know, something where there's an econometric study versus something where they've done lots and lots of in-depth interviews. I'm not saying which is right or wrong, but boy, it's confusing to try and see how you distill what really matters out of all of that. But I thought it was fascinating, and there's lots of food for thought for us. The question there that was said about votes, I'd like to come back. I completely agree with you. I think we're all on about what makes better outcomes here. And actually, I think the idea that the delivery attention was all about votes, I think, well, if it was, it was seriously misplaced. I mean, Michael Barber and I talked about this, and I think point is made in one of the other posters that's up there, that actually perceptions are much more, which if one assumes votes come out of people's perceptions are related to, and I think there's some good evidence now for this, which I've always thought, the difference between what's actually delivered and what's expected to be delivered. What you do by targets is raise the expected level. You might or might not raise the actual delivered level, but it's certainly not targeted on what matters for the votes, which is the gap. So to use the Sir Humphrey expression, going for very stretching targets is very brave, right? Doesn't necessarily tie in with the idea about this being all a political game. On the question of incentives and all the rest of it, I always put this point. Why would you expect the public sector to be as efficient as the private sector when in the private sector, first of all, they have enormously better data? You know, every single one of you provides Tesco's with brilliant data because you put your Nectar card in, and they know precisely how many bottles of wine you bought, when they put it on shelf one rather than shelf two, or when they changed the price and the timing and all sorts of brilliant things they can do. And we don't charge very often for public services, so we have a lot worse data. The second point, of course, which is blindingly obvious, which is when you've got lots of providers in the public sector, if you're not very good at selling groceries, you go broke. So you're not there. Interestingly, Martin's example of when we analyse views about public sector, how good it is by asking people, actually the one person who wouldn't have been asked would have been Martin if he died, because he wouldn't be there to fill in the form. So those people would be great. They're excluded from the sample. We only get the bad health comes, the good health outcomes who may be treated badly. So censored samples are a problem for us. But it is hugely important. So failure regimes is one of the things that I think we find incredibly hard to think about. What do you do with public service providers that aren't doing a very good job? And that is a real challenge, I would say. So I think those things. Another thing that came through, I thought, from a lot of the work was how many people were using devolution as a, quote, natural experiment. And that struck me as rather interesting, that here is a form of difference, and we should be, I think, trying to learn as much as possible from the different experiences where obviously there are lots of kind of natural controls in place, and we've got different policies being taken forward in different parts of the United Kingdom, and our ability to learn from those, I think, is really important. So that's quite a good experimental form. Nothing like as good as the things I'd really like. I would love some random control. Please, please, could I have more random controls? Please, could I have some proper things? But they are, for all sorts of reasons, really difficult to get people to agree to. The key question for me, looking at your title, and this is probably what you're interested in me talking about, is how do we face the challenge? And when I talk to civil servants, I say basically in the next 3 to 4 years, we have two challenges, one certain and one uncertain. The uncertain challenge is, will there be a change of administration because of an election coming up? So basically we work for the government of the day and we prepare on a contingency basis. That's the uncertain. The certain part is partly what Martin was explaining, which is the public finance position. One could argue about nuances, but we all know that we're going forward into a period where there will be a lot lower expenditure in various areas. So, and the Treasury, and in fact, the current government is putting forward some legislation to say it will halve the deficit in 4 years. The main opposition party, in fact, all parties, have talked about getting the deficit down quite considerably. So, to my mind, that's the world we're in. As a former permanent secretary to the Treasury, I'm absolutely clear I know what the Treasury is going to do. And I know what the Treasury will persuade any government coming in is those numbers will be a lot lower. So they'll get, so public expenditure allocated, DELs, if you like, to use the jargon, departmental expenditure limits, will be a lot lower. Now, so the question isn't will we get the numbers under control. The challenge, in my mind, for the civil service and the public sector is given that there's going to be a lot less money, are outcomes going to be as bad as Martin suggested? That's it, right? And our challenge is to ensure they're not. Now, that, to me, is a great opportunity. So what we've got is the question of can we improve public services at the same time as the amount of money going in has gone down a lot? Now, there's certain things we can do. You can work on the cost side of this equation, and that's got fairly obvious implications for pay bills and the like. But there are many, many other things we can do to think about how we improve public services. It's very interesting, and this comes down to the point, I think Richard used the word productivity. That's exactly what it's about. For a year now, I've been going around talking about doing more with less. I think probably achieving more with less is what we're about. That is our key. There are ways of doing this, and you know we could get into the detail of them if you like. What you need is very, very capable departments, which is why we've been working on capability reviews so much, and the ability to innovate. We need to do things rather differently from the way we've done it in the past. We need to look for process changes, different ways of doing things. When you think about some of the innovations that are possible, you realise that you can improve services and reduce costs very dramatically at the same time. There are obvious examples. When you go on, as you will, looking at this audience and guessing about your salary levels between now and the 31st of January and do your online self-assessment on tax, you will be wonderfully participating in an improved public service because we can do it when you want. It will be more efficient because it won't let you go wrong. It gets it into the system. And it will be a factor of somewhere between 10 and 100 more efficient, dramatically more efficient. There are lots of other things. The next generation of services will not be one way. So when we start doing this digital inclusion, getting people online, getting more and more online so we get people off these incredibly expensive, clunky ways of doing things by writing letters, we can improve the quality of services, better access, and we can start stopping them being so old-fashioned about being one way. So when I get you onto the car tax site where you'll brilliantly do this at 4 a.m., as some very sad people seem to do, they pay their bills, could it not come back and say, by the way, you realise the car you're driving, the tax you're paying on that, you could pay a lot less. You could have an advert for the car scrappage scheme. And if you're interested in recycling, why not now the boiler scrappage scheme, etc. You could think about these things. When it comes to getting benefits online, we could be thinking about if you're eligible for this benefit, actually you could be, you're in a group that could do these sorts of things. If it's someone getting certain health benefits, why not at the same time give them some advice which might lead to prevention, which could actually reduce costs quite considerably. There are massively big ways of innovating. And the kind of challenge we've got is not incremental. So there won't be the money, and that will be the necessity of invention. People will then think, because we are public servants, and I think, as again, one of the studies showed, that the degree of altruism is very high and doesn't change across when we had those incentive structures changed. I think that was one clear result. People will, in those circumstances, will work incredibly hard to find ways of keeping the quality of services up. So my prediction, one of my predictions here, is that those productivity levels will change in favour of moving up. When we put more money in, productivity went down. My prediction is, as we lower the amount of money going in, productivity will rise. There are all sorts of reasons to do with that, some bad ones to do with the way productivity is measured, but some very good ones to do with the way the providers of the service will be incredibly incentivized to try and improve the services they give to the public, or at least protect them. They'll have a lot less money, so they will find ways. And as I talked to civil servants this morning in the Home Office, They're all working on ways to solve that problem. They've been at it for quite a while. We've seen this coming. We are working on this agenda. And it's, to my mind, an incredibly good agenda. It is all about leadership. You know, public sector leaders will have to be quite innovative. We will need political leadership as well. But to my mind, this is a job that we as a civil service are up for, want to do. We know there's all sorts of things that can happen. A lot of the ideas are in the Smarter Government document about ways in which one might go about this. Probably too early for it to get a lot of attention. But I think these are outcomes which, irrespective of what happens in the election, will need to be implemented. And I think there's a great chance that we'll be able to do a lot of these things. But when we come to these innovations, unfortunately, I'd love to say there were lots of things in the posters that gave me the brilliant silver bullet for how I could improve outcomes with less money. And I didn't come away with a list of four or five things that I could actually do that with. Therefore, we will need to be thinking very hard about how we do this. I think there are ways, but they get into quite detail and they're very sector-specific and service-specific. But that's the challenge we face. And actually, if you're in the public service, that's what you want to be. You want to be saying, okay, there's a challenge there. For us, it's all about getting the best possible public services, given that we know we're going to have less money. Thank you.
So don't waste a good crisis. See the public sector improve productivity in the way the private sector appears to have done over the past year, and use the internet, that wonderful way of delivering services, vastly more cheaply and more productively than we've done up to now. Questions? Yes. Can you say who you are when you ask?
Vernon Bolton, Oxford University. And Martin Weil, when talking about the previous austerity crisis of the 1970s, said one of the consequences was a high rate of inflation for some years. Of course, another major consequence was very strong distributional conflict, not only between different social classes, perhaps, but within organised labour. And governments had two ways to try and constrain that conflict. The first worked very badly, which was incomes policy, and the second, by another administration in 1979, was to use the market, which led to mass unemployment. Now, obviously, the social structure is very different now, but are there likely to be those strong distributional conflicts arising in society? And if so, how would governments propose to contain them?
Martin?
I think that the sorts of rigidities which led to the distributional conflicts of the 1970s aren't as severe now. I think it quite likely that over the next few years we will see the share of income going to capital decline and the share going to labour increase, which of course was what happened on a very marked scale in the 1970s. But my general sense, and no, this for me is the very real achievement of the British economy over the last 25 years, is that the labour market now functions in quite a different way. And I mean, we will obviously have problems with some people who do badly out of the crisis, but those problems are likely to be with people becoming unemployed rather than what happens to wages in employment. So I think in terms of the functioning of the labour market, obviously we don't know, but I would guess that we aren't going to see the sorts of problems that we saw in the 1970s. Any government, of course, will need to keep an eye on the safety net to worry about the people who, you know, are doing very badly out of the crisis, even despite the pressures that we've been talking about on public spending.
Then you're next.
Tim Loinig from the London School of Economics. Today, when we've been talking about austerity, we've talked about its effect on public service, largely through the vehicle of meaning less money for public services. But I wonder whether we also ought to think about the effect of austerity on the demand for public services. Some demands are going to go down, things like railways, for example, numbers are already down, but demand for others are going to go up. When there's fewer jobs, more people want to stay on at university, for example. So should we also be thinking, therefore, about which public services are going to have extra demand pressures that are going to put extra problems into people trying to run those services?
Sir Gus?
Absolutely right, and that's one of the things we spend a lot of time on. Because there are policy choices, and policy choices have already been made, particularly to raise the amount of money for higher education, to get more students in, to manage through this process. And I guess in terms, the biggest amount of money has really been used in terms of Job Centre Plus and an approach to the labour market, which backs up what Martin said. You know, why is it that unemployment hasn't, you know, the people who were predicting 4 million unemployed, predicting 1 million youth unemployed, why haven't those things come to count? And there's some very, very interesting experiments going on. In the UK, enormous amount of money on getting people who have become unemployed into other jobs. In Germany, they've spent an enormous amount of money keeping people in the same jobs. My guess is German unemployment will rise next year. And I think our policy may turn out to be the better medium-term one. But I think one of the big things that will determine how much money we've got available is what happens to long-term unemployment. Think about the 80s and 90s, big increase in long-term unemployment. That's incredibly costly. I mean, not just for the individuals involved, but for the state in terms of... And if this time this recovery can come about without the big increase in long-term unemployment. Obviously, there'll be some that happens, bound to happen, but that will make a huge difference. The demands for all of the other public services, you're absolutely right, and it'll be a question of how can we manage those processes where there will be there are some interactions between the services. Not least, there'll be questions like how quickly can you improve efficiency in the public sector. If that means reductions in jobs, if you're in a world where the private sector is hiring, that obviously becomes much more efficient than in a world where they're going into unemployment.
Hi, Emma Coleman, Greater London Authority. I just wanted to address the comment to Gus. You say you're identifying leadership and innovation as the two key things that are going to be absolutely essential in the public sector. And one of the consequences, unintended or otherwise, of the audit and inspection regime over the last 10 years is that's actually stripped out leadership and innovation because people have been so focused on hitting targets. So there is going to be some job in terms of you're asking basically organisations that are stuffed full of engineers to become poets, and that's a big ask. So there's a whole organisational development challenge there that's pretty extreme. The second comment I would make is that it's interesting it's taken to this point for the government now to have a focus on smarter government through a digital economy, because the reality is we could have been pushing services much more aggressively online any time over the past 5 years.
Shall I respond? That targets have somehow stopped us becoming leaders. I'm not sure that's true. I would think that what you've got is genuine leaders in the public sector have said and been given by the government clear targets, and what they have done is in many cases delivered on those targets. The point about leadership is what is it, you know, delivering required outcomes, the kind of leadership muscles that have allowed people to deliver certain targets now need to be devoted in other directions towards innovation and the like, and we need to let go somewhat, that's absolutely true, and move to, you know, the example would be, I would take, of crime, where you move to a single target in terms of public confidence in crime. So I think there is an area where we could allow more innovation there. And I think if we've done work, as I think we have within the civil service, on improving the quality of leadership, then I think they will be ready for that sort of thing. The second part of your question was... Why it took so long on digital? Yeah. Well, many of us, I guess, in the room who've had really frustrating experiences with IT projects that have promised that they could do all of this, and that 5 years ago were saying this is going to be completely straightforward. And to be honest, they haven't delivered. And I think quite a lot of that was down to these projects being seen as IT projects, and they're not IT projects. These are about business process, re-engineering, sorting out how to deliver services, and there may or may not be a large component. The reason I'm really keen on this, and this is a point that Martha Lane Fox makes all the time, is I think we come at this the wrong way.
We come at putting services on digitally because we say, isn't that great for us, the producers, because we can? It's incredibly cheaper for us to do it that way. I want to turn it round and say, actually, what I care about is the public and delivering better services. Isn't it incredibly good that we get those people who are at the moment aren't digitally engaged, because, yes, they'll use our services and we can actually help them and give them more access. For the person that's stuck at home, isn't very mobile, we can get to them. But also, by getting them online, we can open them up to a world that is incredibly better. That means that, to take my personal example, when you get that letter that comes through your door saying, please pay £350 for your car insurance, and you go online, the same company is offering you exactly the same insurance for £250. You can then say, okay, I'll have £100 less. Thank you very much. You know, we get them into that digital world. And at the moment, I think we're focused rather more on the public service as opposed to, isn't this going to be great for the individual, the user? And it helps us as well.
Yes. Yeah, this lady.
Thank you. My name is Jean Shaw, Manchester University. The theme of this session, and indeed the whole day, has been one of austerity and cuts. I would like to ask the basic, very basic question. The political agenda of the last 30 years has been driven by the free market, which has dominated politics and intellectual life, and it has been demonstrated to have failed and failed miserably, which is why we are now confronted with having to make cuts, because the public debt threatens national solvency. My question to you is, why should working families pay for the crisis, which is not of their making, through their jobs, through their services, and all the rest? We're not in it altogether. It's not so much business as usual, but better than ever for the financial oligarchy. I was struck when Martin Wheel made the point about, will we get through the 2010s in the same way as the 1910s? And I presumed that he was referring to the threat of wars and indeed social revolution. We're faced with escalating wars that are deeply unpopular and social conflicts. My question, therefore, is why should working families pay for this through the cuts that are being talked about?
OK, Martin?
OK, well, I think a part of the answer is that it won't only be working families that will be paying for it, it'll also be non-working families that will be paying for it. I mean, you raised a number of interesting points. What struck me first was you're saying that the free market has failed. Well, in some sense you could say that's true, but last month we were reminded of the 20th anniversary of the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of communism in Europe. And I think one can say that even if the free market has failed, other non-market systems failed much more spectacularly. I think no one believes that the way the economy operated, particularly in the last few years, was an ideal way to run things, at least with the benefit of hindsight. But you ask, why should particular people pay? Britain's long-term structural problem has been that actually, relative to our income, we're the highest consuming and lowest saving country of all the advanced countries. The United States is very slightly better, but almost every other country makes a lot more provision for the future than we do. If you like, it runs its affairs in a much more sustainable way. Now, the way that the British economy has been run over this last 20-year period, in my view, isn't sustainable. It led to a situation where people's expectations were going to be disappointed. I didn't have any sense of knowing when or how that would happen, but that in part may be what we're seeing now. So my view is that we've spent quite a lot of the last 20 years living in something of a fool's paradise. Arguably, I mean, I said that GDP had fallen sharply. You can make an argument that 2 or 3 years ago it was actually being overstated. And what do I mean by being overstated? That we had an industry, financial services, which was operating by charging commissions, allowing people to turn, you know, to realise capital gains on things like housing. Well, capital gains aren't income, but the commissions are counted as income. But if they're built on unsustainable capital gains, then the income arguably wasn't sustainable and shouldn't have been there in the first place. So my view is that what we're actually seeing is an adjustment to a sort of reality we had allowed ourselves to escape from, and in those sorts of circumstances, you would expect almost everyone to be disappointed and therefore to feel that they're being made to pay for it.
I think that's a very good note on which to bring this fascinating day to an end. I want to thank all our panellists, and particularly those who've chaired panels and so well summed up the events of the day. I want to thank Martin Wheel and Sir Gus O'Donnell, and most of all, I want to thank Christopher Hood for the work that he has done to create all of this.
Ladies and gentlemen, there are drinks waiting for us downstairs, and I hope that many of you will join us for that. But before we do start on that, I would like just to take a few minutes to say a few thank yous of my own. Conferences like this one don't just happen, and this one is the result of a long process in which many people have taken part, and I'm not going to name all of them, otherwise the drinking time would be long postponed. But I should at least thank, first of all, our sponsors, the ESRC, whose guests we are today. I want to thank all of the speakers and the panel chairs for their very thoughtful and clear presentations. I asked all of the speakers to follow the watchword of brevitas et facilitas, and I'm pleased to say that they have all done so. I'm most grateful for that. A highlight, however, of the conference, and the one a part that I hope you found interesting and enlightened, is the 49 posters that describe the discoveries of the programme's work, and to which Sir Gus O'Donnell referred. And I hope you've had a chance to look at those, but if you haven't, you will find that they're all in the CD in your conference pack, so you'll be able to look at them in more leisure. Now, these posters are the result, of course, of input from all of the 47 people who led projects in the programme. But the person that I want to thank especially is Ruth Dixon here, who pulled them all together into the set of posters that you saw downstairs. And I assure you that that was not done in an afternoon. It took her months of work, massive amounts of patience, and what's more, high-level intellectual engagement with people coming at public services from all across the social sciences. And I want to salute Ruth for her efforts on that, because I think that's a lasting achievement. I want to thank as well the other staff from the programme who've worked very hard today to make this conference work. I want to thank Gail Savage and Matt Cladney, who've been working hard behind the scenes today. And I want to also thank Bryony Gill and Ricky Dean, who actually no longer work for the programme, but who very loyally have come back to help us out today. And finally, I want to thank all of you for finding the time in your busy schedules to come here today and to make the very interesting contributions that you have done. Now, I hope you'll join us for a drink. Thank you.